Tango Tango Papa 1851, July 17, 2014.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Edgerton, Wisconsin. So I unloaded earlier, I guess it was this afternoon, in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and then they sent a load that I, you know, it was about it was maybe a mile or maybe a little over a mile away from where I unloaded at. Picked a load up there. That load that I have now goes to back down to Olathe, Kansas, which is a suburb of Kansas City. So I am on my way back to Kansas now. So anyway, nice weather. It's been, I think today it was in the low 80s. It was actually colder at home. I looked at my temperature at home there, and I was kind of surprised that it was like 68 or 69 degrees. So it was actually, probably about 10 degrees, at least 10 degrees difference between here and home. So it was cooler at home. But, you know, maybe that summer's over, and we're probably into a fall, and there might be a little bit more hot weather. I don't know. We're having a very cool summer. It happens. So anyway, I have a bunch of audio to play. I've got several different audio comments, and then also, I don't know if you've heard about it or not. There's this guy. Well, it's a husband and wife. The Veronica Belmont. A lot of people are probably familiar with her. She used to be. I don't know. She's worked for several different media organizations, and I think she recently, you know, most recently she worked for, I can't think of the name of it now. She worked with Patrick Norton. They had this video that they put out. Revision 3 was a company. I think she worked for Revision 3 most recently. And so now I think she has quit. But anyway, her husband is Ryan Block. And Ryan Block has also been kind of, I think he was the editor at Engadget, or he was involved with Engadget. And now he's does something with AOL. But in any case, they were moving from one where, I don't know where they live, but they moved from one place to another, and they were trying to cancel the Comcast account. They had this Comcast account, and so they moved to a different place, and they got a different internet provider. And I guess the story I heard, she was on the phone with them, and she was getting completely frustrated with this guy. And so she put her, you know, she put her husband on the phone, and at that point he began to record the call. And so there's about roughly eight minutes and so many seconds of call. And I've listened to snippets of it, but I've got the whole thing here. And so I'm going to play this. My intent is to play this whole call, and I don't know. Some people find it difficult to listen to, you know, because you get this Comcast rep, and he really is. It's interesting. What I find interesting about it, he's really kind of getting belligerent to a certain extent, and to his credit, Ryan Block is remaining perfectly calm, and you know, and if you're able to do that, this is. For at least the parts of this call that I've heard, if you're able to do that, you know, and then the problem, if someone starts to get belligerent with you or tries to bully you, and this is really the Comcast rep is exhibiting bully behavior. Someone tries to bully you and you don't give them the response that they're looking for, then the egg is really on their face. But otherwise, if you give them the wrong response, if you give them the response they're looking for, basically, and you get upset, you become the problem, and you'll end up going along to get along. And that's what this guy was trying, Comcast rep was really trying to bully Ryan Block. In this case, he was trying to bully him into doing what he wanted him to do. So anyway, let's go ahead and listen to that. It's about, again, it's somewhat over 8 minutes, so here we go.
Okay, we'd like to disconnect, please.
Okay, so why is it that you don't want the faster speed? Help me understand why you don't want faster internet.
Help me understand why you can't just disconnect us.
Because my job is to have a conversation with you about keeping your service, about finding out why it is that you're looking to cancel the service.
I don't understand.
Talk to me, you can definitely go into the Comcast store and disconnect your service there. Okay.
We're just asking for you to
Kill two birds with one stone. You got to return that cable card to the store anyways.
We're actually going to just mail the cable card in, but if you can just please cancel our service, that would be great. That is all we want.
We're actually not able to return a cable card by mail.
Then I will send someone like a Task Rabbit to go return the cable card for us. I don't personally intend to go return the cable card. That's why we're probably not going to be canceling in store. So that's why I need you to cancel by phone. So can you cancel us by phone? But the answer is yes, correct?
I mean, it sounds like you don't want to go over this information with me. I mean, if you're not wanting to go over that information, okay, then that's the easiest way to get your account disconnected.
I am declining to state why we are leaving Comcast because I don't owe you an explanation. So if you can please proceed to the next question. If you have to fill out your form, that's fine. Please proceed to the next question, and we'll attempt to answer that if possible.
Okay. So, I mean, being that we are the number one provider of internet and TV service in the entire country, okay, why is it that you're not wanting to have the number one rated internet service, number one rated TV service available?
I'm declining to state. We're switching providers. Can you please go to the next question?
Okay. So what is it about Astound that's making you want to change to them?
I'm declining to state. Can you please go to the next question so we can cancel our service?
What it is about Comcast service that you're not liking, that you're not wanting to keep. I mean, why is it that you don't want to keep that service?
This phone call is a really, actually amazing representative example of why I don't want to stay with Comcast. So can you please cancel our service?
But I'm trying to help you. Okay.
The way that you can help me is by disconnecting our service. That's how you
but
can help me.
But how is that helping you, though?
Because that's what I want.
Explain to me how that's helping
That's
you.
What I want.
Okay, so why is that what you want?
Because that's what I want.
Okay, so, I mean, there has to be some sort of reason behind it. That's what we're trying to find out. We just want to find out what it is that's causing a customer that's been with us for a long time to leave.
Because that's what we want.
Okay? I mean, you've been with us since, I'm sorry, 2005. 9 years, you've been a Comcast customer. Okay? After a decade, okay, clearly the service was working great for you. You weren't having any problems. So now all of a sudden you're moving. Okay, you've kept this service in multiple addresses. All of a sudden you're moving and something's making you want to change. What is it that's making you want to change that?
Because that's what we want to do.
Okay, why is that what you want to do?
That's none of your business. Your business is to disconnect us, please.
As a company that is a cable and internet provider, primarily, okay, that is our business, to know why our customers are leaving. Okay, if we don't know why our customers are leaving, how are we supposed to make it a better experience for you next time? Okay, when Astound turns out to have
that's a fantastic question and something that you can hire a firm to go figure out. For right now, I'm just a customer calling in, attempting to disconnect service. That is something that you can do, right? You said that you can't disconnect service. Yes?
Okay.
Yes?
Well, I mean, I just don't want to be the customer.
Is that something you can do?
From transferring your service to your new address.
Is that something you can do? Can you disconnect us by phone? Can you disconnect our service? Yes or no?
What I'm trying to find out is
yes or no. Can you disconnect our service?
Faster internet than anyone can provide you. Okay. Why don't you want those services?
Because I'm not interested in your services any longer. Can you?
So you're not interested in the fastest internet in the country?
Nope. Not interested.
Okay. Why is that?
Can you disconnect us by phone? Are you capable in your system of disconnecting our service? Yes or no?
Well, I'm just trying to get some information to find
out why. Please answer my question. Are you capable by phone of disconnecting our service?
It's something we can do. I mean,
okay.
Very rarely do we do it.
That's something you can do. I would appreciate you now doing that.
Okay.
Please proceed in disconnecting our service.
Provider, that's making it sound so much better than the number one TV service available.
I don't know. It's totally arbitrary decision.
Okay, so why not keep what you know works?
Because
you know is a good service.
Because we're not doing that. So please proceed and disconnect
our
service.
You don't want a good service? You don't want something that works?
No, I don't. I guess I don't want something that works.
So why don't you want something that's a good service and something that works?
I mean, is this like a joke? Are you punking us right now?
I'm trying to get information, okay? I'm trying to help our company be better. That's my job.
Okay? I can guarantee you right now you are doing an incredibly good job at helping your company be worse.
Okay. Well, you know what? I'm terribly sorry that it feels like it sounds to you like it feels like I'm trying to argue. I'm just trying to help you out and get some information. We'll just bypass all this information. I'll go ahead and disconnect this service. Okay.
Fantastic.
I mean, it's really a shame to see you go to something that can't give you what we can.
Okay. Well, if that winds up being the case, then we will call you guys back up and we'll reconnect.
I mean, you're not going to get the 100,000 free on-demand titles. You're not going to get 105 megabits per second for your internet. Guaranteed speed at 105. Okay. I mean, no one else can guarantee their speeds like we can. Okay. So, I mean, we can definitely transfer this over to your new address and get you a lower rate. I could save you almost more than $100 per month. I could save you more than $100 per month, okay, doing that transfer. Okay, get you internet that's 5-6 times faster than anything any other company can provide you.
Are you done?
Okay, get you the number one TV service available, okay? And, what about those savings, those services? Are you not wanting?
Are you done?
What makes you
because
don't want that service?
You literally just a moment ago said that you would go ahead and disconnect our service, and that's what we're gonna need to do. So can you go ahead and do that now?
I'm working on that process.
Okay, great.
Okay.
How much longer is that process
gonna
take?
I'm asking some questions.
Can you tell me how much longer?
That's all I'm doing.
Can you tell me how much longer it's gonna take?
Okay, I'm just asking some questions while I'm going through that process.
I understand. Can you tell me how much longer? Can you tell me how much longer?
Okay, a couple more minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, so what about the service? I mean, is it that's causing you to want to change? What about
offers
that we have available to you?
I'm good. I'm just going to wait until you can confirm that we've canceled service. So I'm just going
to
hang out here.
Well, you're all set. It's disconnected. I'm really sorry to see you go to something that can't give you what we can. But I'd like to thank you very much for being a great part of Comcast. Have a wonderful day.
Can you give me a confirmation number for the cancellation of service?
I don't have a confirmation number.
Well, how do I have confirmation that we've got service canceled?
You'll receive a final statement in about 3 weeks.
A final statement in 3 weeks?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. But again, I want to thank you very much for being a great part of Comcast. Have a wonderful day.
And just so I can confirm, you said that your name is...
Correct.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Okay. All right. You're very welcome. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay, so... There you go. There. Jiminy Christmas. By remaining calm, he got his way. He wanted to cancel. And, you know, that is a pretty extreme example. I've had to, you know, there's been times where I've had to tell people no. And you just tell them no. And if you do it, you know, calmly but firmly, you know, they will, you know, they see that they have to respond. And so this guy finally, he just, he was pretty persistent. You know, he kept thinking, I think at one point he thought he was going to turn it all around. Oh, look, I'm going to save you all this money and so on and so forth. And, but that's a great, that's a pretty good example of just remaining calm and, you know, and someone kind of tries to bully you into doing whatever. A lot of people will, you know, will be bullied by that kind of a thing. They'll end up being bullied, and then before you know it, they would change their mind. They would call up to cancel, and then they'd end up not canceling. And furthermore, they would believe that it was their own idea that they didn't cancel. So, anyway, I thought that was kind of that was kind of interesting. And so since then, of course, they published the phone call, and then it kind of went viral. And Comcast has called Ryan Block up and apologized and so on and so forth. But this is the kind of stuff that, you know, that's especially you get the bigger the company, the more likely it is that something like this can happen. And that's especially true if they sort of have a monopoly. And in a lot of cases, Comcast does kind of have a monopoly. You know, they do sort of have a monopoly. And of course, they're wanting to merge, what is it, with another, I don't know, some other company. There's this merger that they're trying to push through, and it's going to make them by far the biggest internet provider of all. And, you know, if that happens, there's just going to be more of this. So the moral of the story is you want to get your way. You know, the biggest thing you can do is to remain calm and just remain as calm and as reasonable as possible. You know, that's not to say that you have to be wimpy or anything. You can be firm, but if you really remain calm, then someone that has you know, that's trying to bully or pressure you into doing something, it'll backfire on them. So anyway, I've got a comment here from Ian. So let's go ahead and listen to Ian. So here is Ian.
Today is Monday, the 14th of July, and I enjoyed your podcast today, Tom. I was just going to make a comment that I do not agree with your legal opinion that the Walmart driver will have the case put on his shoulders rather than on Walmart's shoulders. Can you imagine if the pilot of a plane were to drink a little bit, even though he knows he's not supposed to, gets behind the wheel of the plane and crashes it, 300 people are killed. You would sue Delta or American or whoever the airline was, rather than Joe Blow, the drunken pilot. You would sort of say, okay, well, that's their fault. He's part of their organization. Anyways, this thing will go into trial. We should keep track of the man's name and the case, etc. But I would bet you dollars to donuts that this entertainer that had a few of his friends killed in his van will have a pretty good case. And I think that he will win his case. Anyways, that's just my opinion. I'm not a trial lawyer. I'm not a Clarence Darrow, but there we are. Ciao for now.
Okay, well, thank you, Ian. No, I maybe I didn't make myself clear. And I don't even think I think you're right. Walmart is responsible. You know, because it's the organization. Nonetheless, the organization is still responsible. You know, even though with a truck driver is kind of a unique situation, because the driver's kind of out there, and it really does kind of revolve around the driver. Trucking companies get sued constantly. That's just something that, you know, they have a legal department, they have lawyers, and so the larger the company, the more likely it is that they're sued, you know, that they're being sued at any given point. And so the trucking companies are being sued constantly with things like this. So the company is responsible. Now, I don't know what's going to happen, you know, if this will actually go to trial or if they'll settle out of court. I can tell you that the driver's name has been publicized. His name is Kevin Roper. And, you know, so I don't know how much you'd have. Probably, I don't know if this is going to continue to make national news, or it's probably going to end up, you'd have to just kind of look for the names. The name of the comedian, which now I don't, is it Tracy something? And then this guy, this driver, you just have to make a note of the names and kind of sort of, you know, make a point of following the case whenever it comes to trial or whatever, or if it gets settled out of court or, but, you know, these things, legal things kind of end up moving slowly. But Walmart is responsible. But you know, on the other hand, let's go to your airline example. Let's say you have a pilot, and I'm sure it's happened. I don't know if it's ever caused crashes, but I know that I've read stories before where airline pilots, even though they're not supposed to drink within a certain period, I've read stories where they've, you know, they do drink, and I don't know if it's caused any problems or not. I'm sure it probably has. But let's say that, you know, and of course, truck drivers know they're not supposed to drink. It's very clear in the regulations. Same way with airline, you know, any kind of an airplane pilot or an airline pilot. But let's say they do it anyway. And, you know, they go to work and the employer, even if the employer asks them, make them sign a form, have you been drinking at all? Or unless they do a random, like a pee test on them to check, or a random blood test or a breathalyzer test, that would be one way an airline could verify that somebody, you know, that the pilot hadn't been drinking. Otherwise, it's just up to them to, you know, it's up to the pilot. They're relying on the pilot to be honest. Same way with the truck driver. I guess what they, you know, you would have to, I don't know if there's a test that you can do to make sure that someone has slept enough, but you're really, when it comes right down to it, you're really relying on the person being honest. And if they're not honest, then you end up with a problem. Potentially, you end up with a problem. So, but Walmart obviously is liable because it was a Walmart truck and he was their employee and so on and so forth. So the organization is liable. There's no question about that. But on the other hand, if you still, as a company, have to rely on your people being honest and to a certain, you know, and to the degree that you can, do the right thing. And if they're not honest and they're not doing the right thing and they're pressing themselves beyond a certain point, you know, in this case this driver was up more than 24 hours, then you know, putting himself and the company in sort of in jeopardy, what do you do? You know, so, but to, you know, you can put all kinds of rules in place, you know, and even though the company's liable and it's liable legally, you can put all the rules in place and still have people break those rules and end up with bad consequences. I saw a story earlier today. I was, you know, and this one, you know, it was a trooper, a state trooper, or a policeman. I take that back. It was a policeman somewhere in some city. Now I don't remember where. I just kind of randomly ran across the story. He was parked on the side of the road, and he had his radar gun out, you know, trying to catch speeders, and a truck, and they didn't say, well, they did say it was a J.B. Hunt truck, ran, you know, this was, you know, ran into the car, and it knocked the policeman up against the, like, a concrete wall, and immediately, you know, instantly killed him, and, you know, and they didn't really go into too many details in the story, and, you know, so that you'll probably, that's the last you'll ever hear of that, unless you know the, you know, and I don't even know if they mentioned the J.B. Hunt driver's name. They might have. I think they did, actually. So you'd have to actually find that story, find that guy's name, and follow it. I'm sure there's going to be some sort of a legal thing afterwards, but since it, you know, it wasn't a celebrity in this case that got, you know, it was just a policeman that got killed, you're probably, you know, there's going to be some kind of legal ramification for this guy, you know, hitting the, you know, because obviously he, you know, he wasn't paying attention to what he was doing, this J.B. Hunt driver. But on the other hand, you know, some, there's going to be some consequence to it, but it's not going to be the same as the guy's name's Tracy Morgan. Again, I had never heard of Tracy Morgan until this story kind of came to prominence. I don't watch television, and I don't, that's primarily how this guy became a celebrity, is through, I think, through television. So, but clearly, you know, a company, any kind of company, is liable for their employees. So if I gave that impression, you know, that, you know, I wasn't talking legally. I was just saying, you know, ultimately, you know, truck drivers are kind of in a unique situation in that it really, you know, if you read the laws, a truck driver, you know, when it comes down to it, the truck driver is really kind of out there as far as the liability goes, even more so than the company, but the companies are also liable. So anyway, I've got also got a comment here from Joel. So here is Joel.
Good morning, Tom. Joel McLaughlin, Life in Ohio podcast and elsewhere. I just wanted to say, you know, listen to your last show, the early part where you're talking about Tracy Morgan and suing Walmart. And that's that whole thing. You're entirely right. It's the driver's fault, and the driver probably already lost his job. And I don't know how it all works, but the way I look at it is that Walmart should probably indemnify their drivers. But still, the driver probably has no money. So that's the one I'm thinking of. You know, it's sad that the driver probably also is injured too, but it's crazy that they would try and sue Walmart for what is the driver's fault, in my opinion, you know. I guess they're just following the money, maybe. I don't know. And everyone likes to poke Walmart, you know.
All right. So thank you, Joel. The driver obviously doesn't have any money. So in this case, you know, and you're right. They do like to kind of poke at Walmart, and Walmart's sort of the favorite whipping boy of a lot of people, for whatever reason. It's been kind of politicized, and but on the other hand, they know that stuff like this can happen. you know, because Walmart, among other things, is a gigantic trucking company. They've got, I think it's the biggest private trucking fleet in the world, or in the country, certainly. I don't know about the world, but they've got a gigantic fleet of their own trucks. And so I don't know how much you know about trucking companies, but for years and years and years, larger trucking companies they self-insure. So instead of having going through an insurance company, they basically become their own insurance company, and they set aside so many millions of dollars. I forget the term that the insurance terms that are used, but they set aside so many millions of dollars, just the same way that an insurance company would, in order to have an insurance policy, so much money has to be set aside. And so the trucking companies are able to do that, and they've done this for years. They save themselves a bunch of money by self-insuring that way, and so they're prepared for these things, and they know that a trucking company gets beyond a certain size, they will be sued, and they're you get a big company and it's probably constantly being sued. And while I'm sure Walmart is it's not only is it a trucking company, but it's a retailer with thousands of stores, and so they're getting sued on that end as well. Somebody slips and falls, and then they think, oh, I'm going to sue, and I'm going to sue them, and what have you. So they get a lot of that kind of activity going on as well. So they're prepared for it, and it kind of comes with the territory, I guess. But you can look at the kind of the history, especially the United States. You look at our history, and you can see that starting way back. I really kind of became aware of the sue thing, where people were just suing like crazy. I really became aware of it right probably around maybe 1980, late 70s. Early 80s is when I really became aware that that was sort of the end thing to do. Something goes wrong or whatever, sue, and then maybe you'll win some money. You get win the lottery. And it really kind of goes hand in hand with our moral, kind of our moral problems. So, that's what it's kind of turned into, and I don't know. It's a mess. But, you just have to kind of follow the story and sort of see what happens. And obviously somebody that's a celebrity is going to, it's kind of like this Comcast thing. People knew, know who Jessica or Veronica Belmont is, and they know who Ryan Block is because they've seen them on the tech media. So people are aware of who these people are, and they get lots of traction, because if someone else had posted a call like this, it might have gone viral. Maybe it would have, maybe it wouldn't have. It depends on how good of a call it was. But in this case, they put it out there, and Comcast responded, to at least, called them up and apologized or whatever. But, if you're a celebrity, you're going to get lots of attention versus, someone that isn't a celebrity probably isn't going to get that kind of attention. And that sort of goes hand in hand with this this kind of rotten culture that that we've created. And a lot of it has to do with this, I've been talking about this flocking behavior, and a lot of it just kind of goes hand in hand with that, because once you're separated from your God-given identity, and of course we're all born in sin, we're all sort of born separate to a certain extent, we turn into animals to varying degrees. We can, the more separated we are from that natural God-given identity, the more likely it is that we, you know, we turn into animals, and so we have we exhibit flocking behavior, just like herd behavior, school, like a school of fish behavior. And so just imagine that you've got a, let's imagine you've got a school of fish, and so you're attacking, you know, you attack the school of fish from this side and that side, and you can get them to, you know, you sort of get them to dart this way and dart that way, and same way with a, like a flock of birds or a herd of buffalo, sort of get, or a herd of wildebeests, get them, you know, get them to go this way and that way. What are we doing? You know, you hear the term race baiting. If you can race bait somebody, what does that really mean? It means that you sort of, in a sense, you're causing a sort of a pre-programmed flock behavior. And so we do, that's being done to us in a myriad of different ways. And but with a human being, the darndest thing is you think it's your own, you act out of your own volition. You really wanted to buy that car. You know, even though the salesman knew how to pressure button and get you to do whatever, and or the Comcast rep could bully you and get you to do whatever, you really thought that that's what you wanted. You really wanted the timeshare, or you really wanted this, or you really wanted that, or, and it can come down to you really wanted to marry that person, or so on and so forth. And so the more the more separated we are from that God-given identity, then we just go into a, you know, it becomes a free-for-all, and there are people that know that this flocking behavior exists, and they love punking it. So anyway, on that happy note, I've got some audio here from Mark, and he's responding to the book that I'm reading about the gravity-driven universe. So here is Mark.
Hey, Tom. This is Mark from Georgia, and I've been listening to some of your podcasts regarding the reading of the gravity-driven universe and its theories that are contrary to what's popular today, and some of the thoughts about the origin of matter, the Big Bang, and things of that nature. And I wanted to convey some of things that I had thought about regarding the Big Bang that might explain things in more of a simple way. I once had a physics professor where I went to college, and he was a candidate for the Nobel Prize back in the 80s, and what that was related to was he had an explanation that everything that happens in the universe, everything, can be explained in the language of waves, one way or another. And if it doesn't seem that way, if one digs deep enough, they can discover it. And so, not sure exactly what his Nobel content was, but it was something related to that. And so that sparked my fancy for years, and then I tried to apply that wherever I could to try to discover how can things be explained by waves. And then one day I thought, well, why not the universe itself, the whole thing? And so here's how I see that, and here's how the Big Bang relates to it, seeing the universe as a wave. Imagine a bouncing ball, a super ball. These things you buy at the toy store, you bounce it on a hard surface like concrete or a basketball court, and it bounces like crazy all over the place. So you bounce it once, and it contacts the ground. When it contacts the ground, it sort of mashes and develops energy within itself, and then that energy reverses itself, pushes against the floor, and bounces back up. So there's the cycle of it going up, going down, contacting the ground, bouncing back up, going up, coming down, over and over again. So imagine a high-speed camera looking at that, just from dropping it to where it contacts the ground, then stopping the camera, then restarting the camera as it bounces, as the energy is compressed within the ball, and then it recoils against the floor and pushes itself back up. So if somebody replays that second recording of high-speed video, what they'll see at the very start of the video is a stationary ball compressed on the ground and then suddenly exploding upward. And if that were the only evidence anybody had ever seen of a Super Ball, just that one video, they would think, well, how did that ball get its energy to explode? Well, the answer is seeing the ball in action, it got its energy from the previous fall. And so if you think of the universe as a big, enormous, pulsing entity, then what you have is a previous universe and many previous universes, all made out of the same material. So what we have, what we're living in right now, is this cycle of a universe that was once exploded before. So the Big Bang is really a central point of all that mass that had gravitated to that point from the previous cycle, and it gained its energy from that collapse until it came to a point and then exploded again by the energy of the previous collapse. And that's where, that's a simple explanation, number one, to explain the Big Bang spirit of energy, if you will, and to explain a universe described in waves. And so there's more to that, if you think of it in that term. So my comments here really aren't necessarily related to the description of gravity, whether it's a push from space or a pull from matter, but it's really describing the energy from the Big Bang. So let's summarize again. The universe is a single blob of matter and energy that cycles, it pulsates. It goes from expansion to contraction to a single point to explode to expansion to a height, a maximum height, then a reduction until explode, and it just does that over and over again, forever. And with that in mind, you can answer, where did the Big Bang come from? Where did the energy come from? The answer is, it's always been here. The Big Bang is just one Big Bang out of an infinite number of previous Big Bangs. And it got its energy from the previous explosion, and it will again. So if we're expanding right now as a universe, we will eventually get to a high point, just like the Super Ball at the top of its trajectory. We'll get to a high point, and the gravity of the mass from the middle will pull us to the center again, or gravity of space, however we're going to define gravity. But we'll go to that central point again, and that'll be a very, very energetic moment. And then we will overcompress that center, and energy will have nowhere to go but out again. And that's the way it will be forever. It always has been. And so I think, you know, things are usually explained if they're explained in simple terms. And to me, that's the simple terms of explaining the universe, the Big Bang, and the cycle of existence. Now, I still believe in God. So one might say that for a creation to exist, there has to be a beginning for a creation to be burst forth. And so far, with people who believe in God and accept science, might say that God started the Big Bang, started the universe with the Big Bang. And I claim that it doesn't necessarily have to start at the Big Bang. Of course, an atheist might accept and understand my theory about a pulsating universe and say that it was always here. There never was a beginning, and it's been cycling forever, and it will cycle forever, and there's nothing stopping it, nothing starting it. But a creationist could claim that creation can happen, cycle number one can happen, and I personally think a more simple explanation would be that God created the universe at its height, just like we drop the Super Bowl. When somebody drops a Super Bowl, they don't mash it on the ground and try to get it to pop up. They start from high and just drop it. And physics takes over. It falls and bounces and falls, rises and falls and bounces over and over again. So one might say that God created matter and mass and physics and everything at the outer edges. You know, he's an infinite God. He's everywhere. Why not start at the outer edges where everything's nice and still and stationary and easy to work with and let it take over? Let the engine start. Let it drop to its middle and start a whole bunch of Big Bang cycles. And so that to me is easy to understand. Doesn't necessarily require there to be some super metaphysical, super physical force that only God has to create a Big Bang. This universe can do that by itself. All he has to do is just start the cycle going. So that's what that's my thoughts there. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was the explanation of other things that are not understood by science today. So your latest series of podcasts has to do with gravity. Gravity is something that everybody acknowledges, but no scientist really has a good full understanding of what it is. And there's other things like that too, and one of those things relates to antimatter. Scientists don't really know why there is antimatter, and the other thing that's very puzzling to them is why there is so few antimatter compared to matter that they can observe. So there's theories that it's located on the far reaches of the universe that can't be seen, or our instruments are not able to see them, or whatever. So I'm not sure how they're designed to be seen, but nevertheless, it's something that's a mystery to them. So part of my cycling universe theory, and I call that Mark's cycling universe theory because I've never heard anybody else talk about it, is a topic of perfection versus dampening, or friction, if you will. And I'll talk about that first because it becomes important later. Let's talk about perfection. So imagine a Super Bowl again, bouncing on the floor. Person drops it from a high point, it bounces, it returns up to a point lower than that first height point, bounces, drops to a position even lower, and it will eventually make a dozen or so bounces and then start to dribble around and then stop. And so that's a dampening. A perfection is where there is zero friction in the entire system, zero friction in the ball, and the ball returns to its original height over and over again, perfectly, with no dampening at all. And so a perfection in terms of a cycling of the universe would be described as every bit of matter and energy leaves from the central point after the Big Bang and after its lingering effects until there is no matter or energy in that middle, or some minimal amount as just a result of there being gravity there always. Now, I know you've gone into an explanation from the book that, and there's other scientists that might agree, that the Big Bang is a continuing effort that's always spewing forth universal material. And that might be the case. But for the sake of this argument, every bit of it leaves. And then it expands out to a continuous geometry shape, 3D image of matter dispersed. It may not disperse equally, but nevertheless, it disperses to a point where it then returns. Now, the perfection description is where every bit of what left that middle returns to the middle before the next cycle. In other words, the explosion cannot possibly happen until the last electron, the last quark, the last muon of the last atom returns to that position and then the next explosion can happen, creating the next cycle of a universe. And so it's really hard to imagine that that actually would occur if it occurs. And so what an alternate thought might be that some minimal level of internal compression or bounce or whatever or of central energy is required to activate the next spewing forth. In other words, if there's going to be, you know, there's always the next big bang with the end of every cycle, and that big bang happens, occurs, triggers with a certain minimal energy content and mass content, and some sort of necessity triggers the next explosion. And so when that explosion happens, it would happen before all the matter and energy from the previous universe has returned. And some of that matter might be very nearby, would be caught in the wind of the next explosion. Or some of that matter might be at the far reaches, where it has a long way before it could get back to the middle, so it basically might never return. It would just linger out of the far reaches of the universe. And so that's what I call a dampened universe. And that's probably what would actually occur. And things are still described in waves. It's just a dampened wave. And so the amount of material that burst forth for the next universe is less material than what was available at the previous cycle. So it's not going to necessarily reach that high point that it did before. Just like the bouncing super ball, one bounce after the other dampens out until it sort of dribbles and stops. With so much space and so much matter and so much energy, it's hard to imagine the universe would stop, but maybe it could. So let's get into the matter-antimatter discussion. If you imagine a sine wave drawn on paper, one cycle is actually where you have a horizontal line that represents zero, and then you have a sine wave that swoops above that zero, comes back to zero, swoops under the zero, comes back to zero. And so you have this positive area and negative area of cycle. So a positive area, things that are above that zero line, would be what I call a matter universe, a matter Big Bang. And that's representative of where we're at right now. We live in a matter-contained Big Bang of half of a cycle that is above that zero line. And eventually we'll fall back to the zero line, to where we're going to have a Big Bang will be in our future. And then there'll be another explosion, and that explosion happens below the zero line. With all that matter returning to the center and bursting forth again, it will burst forth with antimatter. And then it'll go out and come back again, and then contract to a single point and burst forth with matter. And so forever we'll go to matter, antimatter, matter, antimatter, matter, antimatter. And so then combine that idea with the idea of a dampened universe, and what you have is lingering material from a top cycle into bottom cycles, and lingering material from bottom cycles into top cycles, and then you have this mix of material from previous universes that are of different states. That would explain why there is so few antimatter observed in our universe, because it's material that has not yet returned to the Big Bang that has just happened. It never made it back, and it hasn't contacted matter yet, so it hasn't disappeared. So it's there, and it's few. And that would explain it. Now, one of the mysteries is what happens when matter contacts antimatter. Scientists think that it just cancels each other out and it disappears into nothingness. Well, I have another theory that there is other dimensions, and one of those dimensions could be what we call heaven. And I think heaven might be filled with physical content. And so matter contacts antimatter that disappears. Maybe it appears an equal amount in heaven, and it's being filled up with this universal matter. You know, it all belongs to God anyway, so why not? And then over time, you'll have more and more lingering material out there from one Big Bang to the next. Eventually, you'll fill up heaven with this universe until it's maybe partially full or completely full, or never able to get above a certain amount. And so I have this thing, you know, I have the Marx theory of the cycling universe. I also have what I'm calling the Marx constant. You know, since nobody else can disprove it yet, I'm just going to say it. There's a Marx constant. The Marx constant is the ratio between the matter and energy necessary to make a next Big Bang versus the amount of energy that is lingering. And I believe that's constant. And then there's another constant of, it is based on randomness, of the lingering material that is out there that comes into contact with material from the present universe that disappears. There's a ratio there of the amount of material that trickles into heaven or some other dimension. And so there's probably some other ratio that says it can't go above, you know, you can never take the entire universe and fill it up with heaven. You can just trickle stuff to it. And I don't really know what effect this has on the happiness of religion or what God wants out of us. But, you know, maybe it's a tithing amount. I don't know. Maybe it ends up being 10%. Who knows? Over an infinite summation of Big Bangs. So it's just it's something that just swims in my head. Anyway, those are my thoughts. I just want to see if you can understand them. As, again, like you said, you know, listen to some theories. You don't have to accept them; just understand them. But if you take those ideas, a cycling universe, Big Bangs that are energized by the previous Big Bangs, and matter and antimatter, and everything's described by waves, everything's kind of put together in a simple fashion, you know, including God making the universe cycle number one from the outer limits rather than from the inside limits. It's all very simple. And so, you know, maybe one day this might become popularized and it might help prove some wild questions out there. Might give some answers. Anyway, enjoy the show. I'll keep listening and keep on trucking.
Okay, well, thank you, Mark. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with Stephen Hawking. You know, he's got a sort of a similar theory. You know, he thinks that, or at least he's expressed the thought in the past that a similar idea that, you know, that the universe would expand to a certain point and then it would begin, you know, then it would contract and it would basically everything would reverse. And he said that even time would reverse, which I don't know how that works, but he thinks that even time itself would reverse and you'd everything would go back down to a single point and then you'd have another Big Bang. So Stephen Hawking kind of has a similar idea. Now there's some sort of flies in the ointment. For one thing, the universe, it's expanding. It is expanding, but it's accelerating. It's not only expanding, but it's accelerating, and it's accelerating at a pretty good rate. So that kind of if it's actually accelerating, if the explosion, if it's a Big Bang and the explosion is actually accelerating, that kind of creates a problem. As far as you'd think that it would slow down and then contract. So then the other problem, well, you know, if we have black holes, of course, and a black hole is, it's got so much gravity that there's so much gravitational effect that even light itself can't escape. Well, it would seem to me that, you know, and if you can have there are black holes that, so they claim, are large enough to swallow entire galaxies. Now imagine that. Imagine a black hole that's large enough to swallow an entire galaxy, or at least intense enough. And so if you had all of the matter in the universe is compacted down to they claim it's like a period on a page. If it goes down to that single little point, I don't see how it could explode to start with. So I don't know. Your theory is very similar to what Stephen Hawking has said. So anyway, what I find interesting is everything is just right. You know, it's kind of like the Goldilocks thing. Everything is just right. The way matter works, and what you were talking about, the antimatter. There's just a little bit of antimatter. And, you know, if theoretically you'd have equal amounts of matter and antimatter, and then there would be no universe. But for some reason, there's very little antimatter and a lot of matter. And so, everything is just right for the universe that we have, you know. And then people start coming up with all kinds of explanations. Well, you know, it's just right. It just so happens that the Earth is there at the right distance from the sun, and it just so happened that the lightning struck the primordial goo, and life sort of arose, and everything just kind of randomly happened, and we ended up with what we ended up with. And I think the fingerprints of God are everywhere. So, anyway, I'm going to go ahead and read chapter 6 of The Gravity Driven Universe by Roy Masters. So it starts out with a quote, and this is a sacred saying in Islam. Islam. Okay, so quote, "I was the hidden treasure. I wanted to be known. Therefore, I created the world so that I would be known." And that's a sacred saying in Islam. "We have established that the pre-time force radial arms, emanating from and revolving and winding omnidirectionally about the timeless creation center, are in reality a form of motion without the need for time as we experience it. I acknowledge that this is a bit difficult for us mortals to grasp, but please bear with me. We here on Earth experience time because those pre-time arms continue to blow over us and pass by, leaving us dragging in their wind, a process which then converts that wind into time relative to our experience. Conversely, we have learned that time and space begin to disappear in direct proportion to any movement in the direction of this time wind. In other words, steady state acceleration approaching the speed of light would tend to close the time-space gap at the approaches to these pre-time arms. It is an established scientific fact that the faster we move, the slower a clock traveling with us ticks, and at some point we approach light velocity, and perhaps beyond light velocity, time stops and time-space disappears. Unfortunately for any space traveler, at that point everything would be flattened, including the space traveler himself, by what would appear to be a dead stop, yet amazingly still moving. Imagine the paradox of moving as faster than light and yet being totally stopped at the same instant. How would matter be squashed flat? There simply wouldn't be any space-time for matter to exist. Not only would your watch slow down and stop, there wouldn't be a watch at all because there wouldn't be any space for it. There would be no time, no space, and no distance. And yet, whatever might be left would still be moving and still at the same instant. We might even question whether there would be anything at all left moving, more likely there would be just one pure motion, or to be more accurate, pre-time force, and other dimensional timeless motion. This, of course, a pure thought experiment. None of this is practically possible, since mass would gather energy into itself, becoming impossibly heavy. No flesh and blood, nothing made of matter, can step across that border and still exist. But just beyond that point, there is another dimension, a parallel universe. The Bible has always maintained that flesh and blood cannot enter the kingdom of God. Remember what I said about those pre-time arms that swirl out of the timeless creation event. They were motion, pre-time motion, force energy. Think of them as motion that does not require time. Think of them as motion from which time and creation as we know them came popping, as it were, out of that interdimensional nothing. What do I mean by nothing? Well, it is not so much a nothing as a no thing, yet to be things. This pre-physical energy motion is a no thing as long as it has not assumed mass, form, and function in space-time. The pre-time motion arms are like that glowing radar screen sweeping around and around, leaving blips of matter on the screen of creation. Such blips simulate the spinning out of matter left behind by those pre-time arms, scanned and re-illuminated with every radar sweep. With each pass of the pre-time arm, atoms are spun, and thus all matter is sustained in time and in existence by omnidirectionally revolving, winding gravity winds. Note, of course, the radar-like sweep mentioned herein is three-dimensional, but for the sake of clarity, I have again used a two-dimensional explanation of this pre-time force phenomena, the radar model. Distance in time and space is simply the difference between where the glowing radar arm in our two-dimensional model is still moving and where the blip of matter popped into existence is left behind in what becomes the time wind. Were it possible, it isn't, for that blip of primordial matter to be reunited with the motion of the radial arm, which is connected to the still center, the space between the blip and the arm would disappear and take the blip with it. They would merge. Of course, this is absolutely impossible, but it makes the point. However, theoretically speaking, if it were possible, the matter blip would conceivably once again fuse and become part of the whole arm, which is still and moving at the same time as a pre-creation phenomena centered in the creative event. If it were possible to live on that moving arm, the pre-time force, where no time and space can exist, you would have to be a spiritual being to do this. You would be able to move in a dimension where there is no time and no space as we know it. Here is a kind of eternity, a timeless quickening, which is almost impossible for us mere mortals to realize. The leading edge of pre-time force defines the boundary whence the physical world came, where the spiritual eternal meets the physical infinite. A stillness moving faster than light. Imagine yourself standing at the center of a circle. Now look at any point on the parameter and fix your attention there, drawing a clear line of sight. If that circle were a wheel and that fixed line of sight a spoke in that wheel, no matter how fast the circle were to turn with you at the hub, nothing would appear to be moving as long as you kept your eye fixed on that point and there was no relevant background. Along your line of sight, nothing moves. Your stillness extends out of the center, but of course it is a moving stillness. This describes the behavior of that pre-time force I spoke of earlier, emanating from a still center. Remember that in the context of creation, this moving stillness eventually becomes time and space to us. If you could be with God and stand at the center of the universe right now, you would be at the source of the creation event, the absolute inertial stillness. The center does not know time as we do, for to God a thousand years are but a day, nay, not even a day. If you could look at a fixed point on the horizon of the universe as it revolved about you, you would not see or experience motion. However, let's say that you started to move along that line of sight, you still wouldn't experience motion. Everything would be perfectly still to you. Now consider walking out on that metaphoric line to the edge of the universe. Even as you moved out, you would experience no motion except that of your own moving. You would not experience any motion like the motion we experience here in this created universe. Bear with me, this is a mystery we are talking about. What I'm trying to say is that it is possible to move in a spiritual dimension without time, in other words, in a pre-time dimension. Let me emphasize that within the boundary of the known universe, coexisting with us in this other dimension into which we cannot enter, unless we are spiritual beings who, of course, can exist in both places. For spirit can enter into matter, but matter cannot enter into spirit. That the spirit can enter into matter is witnessed by the soul of man, and the spirit of God who quickens it, and the door to the spiritual dimension lies within our grasp, just beyond the stillness of our souls. And there it waits across the border of our flesh, where only the noble and perfected souls can travel. Here we can live forever, moving and having our being in a timeless way. Part of you now, even as you read, bears witness to what I say here. Alas, this part is also being tugged in another direction, pulled down by the gravity of creation, the slavish obedience of our souls to the conditioning of sin. You may measure how far you are from the eternal life by becoming aware of the gravity pull of your slavish reactions, your oversensitivity to stress, which represents your slavery to sin. The prideful soul does not have any affinity or yearning for God. It is not obedient to Him. Together with his own flesh, it is attached to the love of the world and affection for the creature rather than the Creator. It is thus doomed to remain in this dimension of time and space, fully identified with the body's demise and final dissolution beyond. Everywhere from the center to the curved horizon of the universe, this pre-time timeless motion encompasses us. Imprisoned in our matter form, we have an existence limited by time. We need to use this time wisely to find our timeless end at the beginning. The entrance to this parallel universe, this kingdom of heaven, is within us all. It is the Alpha and Omega referred to in the scripture. In the Gospel of Thomas, the disciples asked Jesus, "Tell us how our end will be." Jesus said, "Have you discovered then the beginning that you look for the end? For where the beginning is, there will be the end. Blessed is he who will take his place in the beginning. He will know the end and will not experience death." The magic of slowing down. Sitting in an armchair is about as slow as anyone can go in this life, and yet in the macrocosm, we are not only moving, but we are moving at tremendous velocity through space. Without meditation seeking this stillness, we cannot slow down, simply because any physical attempt toward slowness in any direction can only be a greater motion in the direction of timeless annihilation. Only the repentant soul who has used it this time on earth to shed the gravitational pull of sin is free to step across the inner void to eternal life. Somewhere beyond the velocity of light, there exists this leading edge of eternity. Somewhere beyond the swirling pre-time arms of timeless motion is the parallel dimension, a universe in which spiritual beings move and have their eternal being, the center of which is the light of God. the light of creation, the light of souls, the ever-present shedder of eternal light upon the cosmos. God is omnipresent. He transcends the time-space continuum. He operates independently of the dimensions of length, height, width, and time. Here in the everlasting now, souls are eternally renewed in the light of the eternal sun. Remember, though, while this dimension, the universe and its inhabitants, came from a physical beginning through time and space, the way back to our spiritual beginner is within, full circle. Those who find the stillness of the spirit are born of this light and remolded through their minds from within. While their outer earthly bodies were in motion, their inner souls were being formed, shaped from this still, timeless realm, so at the dissolution of their earthly form, they step across to the other side, compatible with the light from which they were formed. And one day those reborn of God shall return to this earth, reclothed in a new kind of covering, and for them there will be no second death. For the final resting place of man is this earth, this Emerald Isle, and the home of God is man made in his image. Know ye that ye are the temple of the living God, and the Spirit dwelleth within. And so that is the end of chapter 6. And so when we start next time, we'll be ready for chapter 7. So I think I'm going to go ahead and bring this to a close for right now. Hope everyone tomorrow's Friday. So hope the week is just about over. So hope everyone's having a great week, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.